You're with us for the morning show as we spend the hour on Wisconsin's energy mix and the state of renewables. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. As the COVID-19 pandemic has brought the world economy to a standstill, greenhouse gas emissions have plummeted. But what does that mean for the changing climate and the future of renewable energy here in Wisconsin? We're exploring that question, getting at the heart of it, with your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Greg Nemeth is a public affairs professor at UW-Madison. He's author of the 2019 book called How Solar Energy Became Cheap. Greg, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. Good morning, Kate. It's good to be here.
And Sarah Johnston is here, an assistant professor of natural resource economics at UW-Madison. Sarah, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. Let's start with you, Sarah. At the present moment, you know, here we are for about 2 months, most of life in Wisconsin on pause. Do we know how COVID-19 has affected our state's energy consumption?
We know a little bit. Certainly nationwide, we've seen a big drop in personal vehicle travel as well as air travel. Some estimates are that personal vehicle travel fell about 40%, and presumably that's true in Wisconsin as well. Electricity in the Midwest, and including Wisconsin, is down about 10% as well.
So what might that impact of driving so much less, filling up at the gas station so much less, what does that have on our changing climate?
So certainly in the short term, we're seeing quite a fall in carbon emissions. I think under lockdowns, the order is maybe 25% fall. But in the scheme of things, hopefully this will only happen for a couple of months, and so it won't have a big impact overall in climate emissions.
Greg, can you start out with us by differentiating between energy consumption and electricity use?
Yeah, although I'm a pleasure to do that because that's something I do in my classes quite a bit. So when I talk about electricity, it's really, you know, moving electrons so that we can plug things in our houses, our businesses, and in industry. And when I say energy, it's a bigger bucket than that. It's all of the electricity plus natural gas that we use to heat our homes and run industrial processes, as well as gasoline and other petroleum products that we use for vehicles. So if you think about energy, it's all of the things that Sarah mentioned, vehicles, electricity use, and industry and agriculture using energy as well. So it's a broader picture when we say energy.
And electricity is more of a specific picture, a smaller piece of that, if you will.
Right.
What do these last 2 months show us, Greg, about our individual energy consumption and how our activity contributes to carbon emissions?
Yeah, that's a good question because, you know, we often think about the energy sector and electricity specifically as being affected by the choices by large entities, by what governments do on policy and what large companies do in terms of their power plants or how they run their fleets or fuel their airlines. But as Sarah focused on, you know, a lot of it, what we're seeing is what individuals have chosen to do in dealing with the last couple of months in terms of how much they drive, how much they fly, and how much they use other forms of electricity. And so you can see that ultimately the amount of energy that we use depends a lot on individuals, whether it's individual households or drivers or businesses, and that can make a big effect. So when we think about the future and thinking about the future energy mix and the future of carbon emissions and climate change, individuals have a really big role to play. I would also say, though, that there are large decisions that non-individual entities make, like what type of power plant to build next, how we're going to fuel our government activities, and what types of policies we make. Those affect decisions on a larger scale, too. So it's really a mix of individual behavior plus these larger infrastructure and bigger decisions that affect the future as well.
We're talking with Greg Nemeth, who studies international environmental policy. Sarah Johnston is here, professor of natural resource economics, both at UW-Madison. We're looking at how the pandemic has temporarily altered energy consumption and what comes next. You can join in the conversation. How have you seen your energy use change during COVID-19? Are you driving less, using less electricity in your home, maybe more. What do you want to know about our state's energy sources? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah, one of your UW-Madison colleagues told WPR that for these COVID emission reductions to combat climate change, we would need to a drop of this magnitude to happen each year for decades. And that obviously isn't sustainable. So what is sustainable for the energy industry regarding climate change right now?
So I think one thing that's happening certainly in terms of electricity is that we're seeing more and more electricity coming from renewables. Obviously, there's been a little bit of a setback with the COVID-19 pandemic. There's some uncertainty now about what things are going to look like over the next couple of years. But as we shift to generating more electricity from renewables, there's going to be less carbon emissions associated with that. And then personal travel, we saw that there was a big drop in personal vehicle travel, and that led to quite a big drop in emissions. You can think about if we shift over to electric vehicles, that'd be something where, as we're simultaneously shifting to renewable electricity, we could think about seeing some big drops in carbon emissions from vehicle use as well. And then, of course, as Greg said, we've seen a lot of change in behavior now. People changing their behavior, for example, working from home instead of commuting to work. Certainly that is going to be part of it as well, some behavioral changes that reduce emissions.
I would imagine, too, as companies give the option to their employees to work from home and not commute into offices each day, that, too, could have an impact on the footprint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And it seems like very likely that, you know, because of this, companies became more used to people working from home, and it became, you know, maybe once it's safe to go back into the office, we'll see still many workers working from home just because we've developed kind of comfort with this new way of working.
So, Greg, you have kind of a triangle here in terms of what you look in the challenge of climate change. And then it's clean sourcing of energy, efficiency, and then less use overall. Can you help us with that mix? What do you see there?
Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe, and even to broaden it to that, so we can do the kind of the technical changes, which is being more efficient with how we use our energy. So that might mean driving a car that's twice as fuel efficient, or replacing our light bulbs with the old incandescent light bulbs and putting in LEDs. So that's efficiency. That makes us get the same amount of energy service with less energy, and as a result, less pollution coming out of that. So that's one thing. A second is to change the mix of energy that we use. So if we do the same amount of, say, electricity, but we power it from, say, renewables and nuclear rather than coal and natural gas, that leads to less pollution, but again, with the same energy service. And then there's other ways of just switching mode to using less. So if people are working at home, they're maybe still able to get their jobs done, but they're not consuming and polluting with the transportation they do. So there's efficiency in terms of technology. There's a mix of low carbon technology. And then there's the consumption of using less. So that, yeah, those are three key things we can do. Interestingly, though, you know, when I talk about this in a broader picture in my classes, I had a couple of other things that we could do that affect energy use. And one is whether the economy grows or shrinks, and another is how many people they are. And so over time, as the world has gotten larger, a lot of the impacts in terms of climate change and pollution have come from higher populations. So that's one thing that I think most people think there's not a lot we could do on population to affect pollution.
Well, let's let's pause right there with Greg Nemeth, a professor of public affairs at UW-Madison. We have Sarah Johnston as well, assistant professor of natural resource economics at UW-Madison. Your thoughts on climate change and the energy consumption, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about renewable energy here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In just the first 4.5 months of this year, America's wind turbines, solar panels, and hydroelectric dams produced more electricity than coal on 90 days, shattering last year's record of 38 days for the entire year. Our country is on track to produce more electricity this year from renewable power than from coal for the first time on record. What questions do you have about our state's energy sources? What policies do you want enacted? Is your energy consumption changing during the pandemic? How so? Join in 800-642-1234. We have UW-Madison's Sarah Johnston, who teaches natural resource economics, and Greg Nemet is here, UW-Madison public affairs professor, who teaches environmental policy. So, Greg, you were talking there about a rising population, an increasing population, and what impact that has on our energy choices and on climate change.
Yeah, thanks. So rising population has affected these issues, but there's not that much we can do about it in terms of that really making a difference in terms of reducing our energy use or our emissions in the future. And the last one that's made a big difference in the long term has been economic growth. So the economy has been, you know, doubling every few decades over centuries. And so that's led to big impacts in terms of how much energy use and how much pollution we create. And that's the part that I also don't think we really want to do. We don't really want to slow down the economy to get pollution reductions. That's a pretty hard and painful way to do it. And that's really the way that we've been accomplishing the emissions reductions we've seen over the last couple of months. It's just slowing down economic growth. So I'm much less optimistic that gives us a path forward. So it's really about changing behavior, reducing consumption through more efficient energy use, and then changing the mix of energy to be less carbon polluting. And I'm actually pretty optimistic that those three avenues give us a path forward on dealing with carbon emissions and climate change.
Sarah, can you walk us through our state's energy makeup as it stands? How much of our state is powered by renewables, nuclear, and fossil fuels?
So in terms of electricity that we use in Wisconsin, or at least electricity generated in Wisconsin, it's about half coal, which is quite high, although that's not the case. As you've pointed out, these last 3 months have been quite hard in terms of coal, and there's been a big decrease in coal generation, and it's because we've seen a big fall in electricity demand, or at least on the order of 10% in the Midwest. And when we were deciding what electricity to use first in terms of renewables, natural gas, or coal, renewables are expensive to build these projects, but then once you've built them, it doesn't cost anything to generate the electricity. And so we're always going to use those first. And then coal has been what we've seen a decrease in generation in response to this drop in demand. And so Wisconsin still has quite a bit of coal electricity generation. It also has some nuclear, and then relatively small amount of electricity generated from renewables in Wisconsin. But that's going to be changing a bit over the next couple of years. There's been some new solar projects that are getting built in Wisconsin. And so I think that's probably going to accelerate the decrease in the reliance on coal that we're seeing in Wisconsin.
And when you look at renewable sources here in Wisconsin, are you mainly looking at solar and wind?
I'm talking in terms of new generation that's being built in Wisconsin. It's mainly solar in the next few years. There's also some wind projects, but not as many in Wisconsin, particularly compared to neighboring states. There's also nuclear. There's a nuclear plant in Wisconsin, but that's something that we're not building new nuclear plants right now.
Greg, when you look at past economic recessions, you're talking about economic growth there. How did the rate of carbon emissions change?
Yeah, that's a good question, because we've had these, the financial crisis in 08, 09 and previous crises in our country and other countries before that. And people who have gone back to look at what happened to emissions find that you do get reductions in carbon emissions for, say, 5 or 10% for a year or two when you have these big, sometimes international economic downturns. But there's always a rebound back, not only to the earlier levels, but back to the earlier trajectory of growth year after year. So when we see the reductions we've seen over the last couple of months, and maybe that'll happen for the whole year overall, that we'll have a reduction, that only gives us a little bit of time. But what we really need is to be changing the trajectory of global emissions and our state emissions to not increase anymore, to flatten, and then really quite steeply drop over the next decade or two. And so what happens with COVID in the next months or year or two really doesn't have a big effect on that long-term trajectory, unless we somehow take advantage of the pause we have and make some changes in how we invest in energy and how we use it. And there's potential to do that.
We're talking with UW-Madison energy experts. Greg Nebbett is here, Sarah Johnston. They're bringing us up to speed on how our state's energy sources have been changing during COVID and what could lie ahead. Do you work in the energy sector? What have you learned over the years? What would you like to share about your work and about Wisconsin's energy mix? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Greg, you've immersed yourself in the solar world with your book last year and your research. Solar represented 40% of all new electricity generation capacity in the U.S., which is growth there. What are you seeing out of solar in recent decades?
Yeah, I mean, the solar story, I mean, it was really fun to write a book on solar because there's been so much change. It's been so dynamic, and that continues today. And, you know, the biggest change is how it's gone from something that was kind of an interesting technology that Albert Einstein had a big role in setting up in the really beginning of the last century to becoming something that large countries fight over. So U.S. and China and the EU also had a fight over solar subsidies 5 or 6 years ago. It's something where electric utilities that have been in business for 80 or 90 years are really struggling with their business models because of what's happening with solar. And what's happened with solar in general is pretty amazing, is that it's gotten unbelievably cheap over the last, well, decades, but especially in the last 10 years, and it continues to get cheaper in the last few years, so much that it keeps surprising people. So prices are below where experts thought solar would be in 2030. They're below that now. And then I think most dramatically for me is, you know, living in Wisconsin and, you know, looking up at the sky today and thinking about how much sunlight we get here. There are solar projects going in Wisconsin now because there's large companies that see that as the best way to supply electricity and the cheapest way to do that. And it's not really, a lot of those decisions are not because they are meant to be green or avoiding pollution. They're really just the cheapest way to provide electricity. And I don't think anyone thought that would have been happening 5 years ago anywhere. And no one, I don't think, would have thought it would be happening in Wisconsin in the near future. But it is happening. It's happening because in sunny places, solar is the cheapest way that humans have ever found to produce electricity in history. If you look at places like Arizona or even sunnier places than that, that's true. But it's even true in Wisconsin that we're talking about. Last I checked, 26 new large solar projects have at least some plans to go in the state. And that represents, you know, more than 4 gigawatts. So that's like more than 4 very large coal power plants of electricity could go into, a little bit less than that. Could go into the state in the next couple of years, and there may be more on the drawing board after that as well.
Well, let's take a call on this. Ken is with us from Madison. Hi, Ken.
Good morning. I use what's called time-of-use metering at my home, offered by Alliant Energy. So there are 3 different times during the day that during high peak is priced a little more than regular electricity price. And then you've got a time frame that is lower. And then from 11 p.m. to 6 a.m., you have the cost of the electricity is less than half of normal. And plus, all weekend long, it's half of what normal electrical price is. So this is benefiting me by my utility amount during the year, but it's also helping to not need as much generation.
It helps the grid. Sarah, could you weigh in on time-of-use metering and the impact on our overall energy consumption and the grid?
Yes. So, yeah, like you said, you know, if we get this, basically we have to build enough electricity generation to meet demand at the peak time, which typically is a few hours in the summer. We have this peak. But then throughout the year, typically in the early morning, before people go to work, and then when people come back home and start cooling off their house, we see these peaks. And so if we can shift usage away from those times, we have to build less electricity generation. So in terms of carbon emission, if we're still using the same amount of electricity, we're not going to see a big effect of that. But in terms of the cost of actually supplying that electricity, we're going to see a decrease because we have to build less generation.
Pause there with Sarah Johnston, UW-Madison Assistant Professor of Natural Resource Economics. Greg Nemeth here, Public Affairs Professor. You can join in. Grid is changing faster than expected, but will that momentum toward renewables continue? Join in 800-642-1234. Back after a news update on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just a quick mention here on the effects of COVID-19 on Wisconsin. Our WPR reporters are stationed around the state bringing you the latest news and developments. You can find a hive of information, ask questions at wpr.org/COVID. Right now, we're talking about the future of energy consumption in America and how it will affect our changing climate. The Energy Information Administration expects wind and solar generation to increase this year. Meanwhile, we're seeing the decline of coal power. Is this a defining moment for our energy consumption? What should happen at this crossroads? Will renewables take hold in this momentary blip during a global health crisis? Be part of this, 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We have Greg Nemeth, a UW-Madison public affairs professor. His book out last year is called How Solar Energy Became Cheap. And UW-Madison's Sarah Johnston is an assistant professor teaching courses in environmental economics. So, Sarah, we are talking there about time-of-use metering and shifting power consumption away from peak demand that is driving real savings for both customers and utilities. How is that working?
So like we talked about, utilities have to build fewer electricity generators when the peaks are less steep, and then that savings can be passed on to customers or ratepayers. One thing that's been a little interesting with the stay-at-home orders is we've seen it's still the case that electricity demand varies a lot over the course of the day, but we've seen the peaks get less peaky, the peak in the morning and then in the afternoon and evening when typically people are coming home from work. We've seen that become a little bit flatter as people are staying home and using electricity a little bit more regularly over the course of the day.
Oh, so we're kind of seeing a steady level across the course of the day hours. So, Greg, how does time-of-use rates work with solar panels?
Well, I mean, whether your solar panel makes you money and how quickly it pays back the investment you make on it really depends heavily on the rates that you get. And for most people that put in solar on their households, they're not going to be able to use all of that electricity that they produce from their solar panels at the time that it's actually being produced. So one solution to that is you get a battery and you put it in your garage or your basement. And until recently, that's really been cost prohibitive. But that's starting to change. Batteries are starting to become more affordable. And a lot of other places, up to half of new solar installations have batteries with them. The other option, if you don't have a battery and you have more electricity coming from your solar panel than you can use, is to sell it back to the electricity grid. And so a lot of whether your panel makes money or not depends on the rate that you get when you're selling it back into the grid. And that's where the devil's in the details. And that's where really rate making, whether it's time of use making, but also the level of the rate, or if there's a specific rate that you get for selling solar back into the grid, that really makes a difference about whether your solar panels are going to pay off in a few years or more like 7 to 10 years. And that really comes down to the Public Service Commission in the state of Wisconsin, and similar in other states as well. They're the ones that decide not only the level of the rates that we pay on our electricity bills, but also what the specific rates are in terms of times and time of use, and whether solar gets specific rates for selling back into the grid. And I think that's a lot of people don't have a lot of visibility on the Public Service Commission, but it's absolutely crucial to the long-term energy future in our state, because it affects things about adoption decisions of solar panels, but also about whether the new power plants in the future we build will be low carbon or high carbon. And so that's when we say time of use rates, a lot of it comes down to three commissioners that are appointed by governors that really make these decisions. So I think that's where a lot of the future comes down to, is their decisions.
Greg, is there much variability between utilities on those sellback rates for consumers?
That's a good question. I'm not really clear on that one. That's a good. There's a lot of variability across states and also over time, and that can affect things quite a bit. And yeah, I think to some extent, but I actually don't know the answer to that one.
Sarah, how does Wisconsin's renewable energy makeup, how do we compare to other states?
So we have, in Wisconsin, I would say a little bit less in terms of wind and solar than other states. Certainly in the Midwest, surrounding states have much more wind energy. But solar, I think we're going to be a leader in the Midwest in terms of large-scale solar projects, assuming that all the projects that are planned, or at least most of the projects that are planned, come online over the next few years.
How have you seen the pandemic affect the supply chain for renewable energy? Are projects moving forward?
So for the most part, projects are moving forward, but there has been some supply chain disruptions, particularly for both wind and solar projects. There's some components are coming from U.S. manufacturers, but also from abroad, and particularly China is a manufactures a lot of these components. And so at least in Wisconsin, we have two very large solar projects that are scheduled. They were scheduled to be completed in 2020.
And one of those, Badger Hollow and Two Creeks. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. And so Two Creeks initially said that they might be delays due to the supply chain disruption. But now it's actually back on schedule and scheduled to be completed by the end of the year. Badger Hollow, unfortunately, has been delayed for 4 months. And there, I don't think the problem was the supply chain so much as that we were expecting to have 200 workers from all over the country come build this wind or the solar project, and just the logistics of people traveling and housing these workers proved to be too difficult with the current pandemic.
So Badger Hollow is in Iowa County. This is on about 3,500 acres. Greg, can you give us the magnitude of how much power this would produce?
So those two projects are both between 100 and 200 megawatts. And so that's kind of the same scale that we might build kind of a medium-sized natural gas power plant. Like there's one on the UW campus that's 150 megawatts. So it's that same scale. It doesn't produce the same amount of electricity because you only get sun about a quarter of the time. And so you need about four times as, or maybe two or three times as much capacity to match it up to a natural gas power plant. But, you know, that would be enough to fuel, you know, a good size of part of the city of Madison, for example. So these are big plants, and we're talking about, you know, doing maybe a couple of dozen of those over the next couple of years. And so that could make a pretty substantial difference to the state's energy mix. And as Sarah said, that puts Wisconsin on the map as a place that's actually growing its renewable share and leading in the Midwest, rather than one that seems to have been over the last 10 or 15 years kind of lagging quite far behind our neighbors.
And I looked at the Two Creeks. 500,000 solar panels that seems like a lot of solar panels on 800 acres. I think you would just look at a sea of solar panels, would you not?
Well, it depends where you're looking from. Like if you're looking from above, like with a drone or a plane, or if you're a bird, you would see that. But, you know, one thing that's gotten quite better over time as we've started to adopt these technologies is to think about, you know, pretty simple things like keeping a hedgerow between where the panels are installed and, say, roads or other viewpoints can make a really big difference. Keeping cover crops and sometimes even productive crops next to and underneath the panels can allow some agricultural productivity with the panels, as well as making it look more assimilated into the landscape. And so there's no question that the scale of doing anything on energy will always be large. And so that's always going to be a challenge. If we're going to do more than a trivial amount of solar, we're going to see it. We're going to see it on people's roofs. We're going to see it on schools, and we're going to see it to some extent in the landscape. But it can be done well. And there are a lot of people out there that are working on that, of trying to integrate the solar into the landscape and do simple things. And sometimes it's in the siting plans, and sometimes it's even in the plans that need to get approved by the Public Service Commission, of doing things like making sure there's a buffer against to roads and other viewpoints. That can make a real difference. So there's no question that they're large, and then the question is how they're done, and they can be done in a way that fits.
Talking with Greg Nemeth, who teaches public policy at UW-Madison. Sarah Johnston's expertise is in natural resource economics. We're looking at the future of energy consumption and Wisconsin's energy sources at 800-642-1234. Greg, as you look at other large projects coming online in solar, who gives those projects the green light, and where do they find their funding to put together these projects?
Yeah, that's a good question. So one thing with, you know, doing renewables and then the associated things like maybe putting a storage project in, maybe building some new transmission, or at least connecting the renewables or the solar to the grid, is that there's many entities involved. So someone has to initiate the project. So that might be a developer whose specialty is building power plants, and that could be a local company or a national company. Then they have to find a customer for the electricity. And so they usually get an electric utility to come up to an agreement to say, okay, we'll buy half of the electricity that comes from that solar power plant. It has to get approved by the entity that coordinates transmission in a large scale, like in the whole Midwest. That's called the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator. And so they have to say, okay, where you're putting in that new solar plant fits, it's not going to create too much congestion, or if it does, you need to build extra transmission capacity. So they have to say yes. I mentioned the Public Service Commission. They have to say yes. And when the Public Service Commission makes their decisions about how that's going to affect rates for ratepayers and whether there's actually demand for the electricity, there's public comment that affects that as well. And so some of these things like siting and whether a new plant is going to interrupt the landscape has to pass muster with the public. And so there's a variety of entities involved. And so to get one of these projects online is a pretty big accomplishment because all of those entities have to say yes.
Lots of sign-offs there. Greg Nemeth, a UW-Madison public affairs professor. Sarah Johnston here teaches applied economics and energy economics at UW-Madison. Your thoughts, do you have solar panels on your house? How do you heat your home? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coronavirus lockdowns have led to the biggest fall in energy demand in 70 years. Renewables have increased their contribution to the energy mix as fossil fuel demand has seen a widespread fall. Is this momentary? Could it carry on? What do you want to know about energy use? How could policies chart a new course for renewables? What do you want to know about in energy policy? Be part of this. 800-642-1234. We have Greg Nemeth, who teaches environmental policy at UW-Madison, and Sarah Johnston, who also teaches natural resource economics, and they stay with us. So, Sarah, the federal government has offered subsidies in the past, tax credits for renewable energy expansion. How have these credits worked, and are they continuing into the future?
Yeah, so the federal government offers a big investment tax credit for solar energy and then a production tax credit for wind energy. And these tax credits have been phased out. And so in 2015, to provide some certainty to the industry, they started this phase out of the tax credits. And so they should be almost completely phased out over the next couple of years. One issue that's come up with the delays with the supply chain is that during this phase out, there's a lot of different deadlines. Basically, if you start construction by a certain date, you can qualify for 80% of the initial full subsidy. By another date, it would be 60%. And then also, along with that, you don't need to just start construction, but you need to finish construction by a certain day. And so one of the big things the industries are pushing for is just extending the deadlines with what they meet, they need to meet in terms of construction to get the full subsidy, to get qualify for these subsidies.
Why are these programs being phased out?
I think it's mostly a success story. So they're being phased out because the costs for, as Greg was talking about, for solar and then also for wind have come way down. And so they're competitive with other types of generation, even without these federal subsidies.
So, Greg, for the first time, the U.S. is on track to produce more electricity from renewables than from coal. Is Wisconsin lowering its use of coal? You know, if it's at 50%, is it going down?
It is, yeah. You know, we our peak coal use in Wisconsin for electricity was 2005, and we're down about 25% since then. We're now less than 50%. And if you even look at kind of this year for 1 month, say in January, coal use is down in the mid-30s. It's about the same as natural gas. So, yeah, like other places in the U.S., we're shifting away from coal. And that's something that 10 years ago, the U.S., Wisconsin, were talking about building much, much more coal. And so if you would think that 10 years later we'd be retiring, a quarter of the U.S.'s coal fleet has been retired in the last 10 years. And it's not because, you know, these are 80-year-old coal plants that just don't work anymore and we're building something else. These are, some of them are not that old. And it's just become, well, for a variety of reasons, it's become uneconomically and otherwise not attractive to run coal. So, yeah, what's happening in the U.S. is also happening in Wisconsin. So we've gone from a more coal-intensive state to a less coal-intensive state, and it seems like we're continuing in that direction.
So when these plants are taken offline, they have to have something that is online ready to go to replace that energy. What do you see there?
Yeah, so until recently, that was a really simple answer. So if you take off a coal plant, you build a natural gas plant, and that's really been the function of a couple things. One is the technology for producing electricity from natural gas has become very well mature and very efficient. And also because of fracking in other parts of the country, the cost of natural gas has come way down. So that was really an easy answer until recently. But with wind costs having come down, solar costs having come down a lot more than wind and now are actually often below wind, and then with some storage technology like batteries and sometimes very large batteries that you could use to hold on to that energy for a while until it's actually needed, not just when it's sunny or windy, we've started to talk about using those technologies to replace coal power plants. And there was a really large coal power plant that was just announced last week to shut down that's in North Dakota, but some of that electricity comes to Minnesota and even some of it to us, that most of that will be replaced by wind power and a lot of storage going in there as well. So that's a newer story. So it's really, when you shut down a coal plant, it's a really intense competition between natural gas, wind, and solar to replace that coal. And having storage there that's cheap, reliable, and available is starting to tilt those decisions towards wind and solar instead of towards natural gas.
Well, it sounds like it also provides more energy options at the energy buffet table, if you will. You know, these utilities can perhaps shop around, pick and choose.
Yeah, and I think that the availability to pick and choose is really attractive to developers, to utilities, because, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty out there. There's a lot of uncertainty in terms of how the future is going to pan out in terms of state and national policy, whether we're going to get very serious or just a little bit about climate change and policies to deal with that. Is it going to be that half of our cars are going to be run on electric vehicles in the next 10 or 15 years, in which case we need more electricity than we do now? And all of those decisions are hard to answer and hard to predict. So having options available, having, you know, a mix of responses, to your point, is really attractive. And so we're in a much better situation to have a more diverse energy mix now than we were, say, 10, 15 years ago.
Talking with Greg Nemeth, who looks at environmental policy at UW-Madison. Sarah Johnston studies natural resource economics at UW-Madison. Your thoughts as well. Do you think we need action from lawmakers on energy sources to combat climate change? What would you like to see? We're at 800-642-1234. Eric in Madison couldn't stay with us, but wants to know about nuclear. Eric asks, is it a dying breed? Sarah, what about this energy source?
So certainly right now, I don't think it's that economical to build new large-scale nuclear reactors. One thing that's contributing that, in addition to renewables, is also the price of natural gas is quite low right now. So natural gas generation is quite cheap. That could change. Certainly the U.S. wants to keep its expertise in nuclear, and so now we're developing these small-scale nuclear reactors. So potentially in the, you know, coming years down the line, we'll see nuclear again. Certainly it's attractive in terms of carbon emissions, but at least in the short term, we're not seeing a lot of new nuclear plants.
Well, Greg, what do you have your eye on? I know solar has really been your bread and butter, but is there something you're watching as you look at the energy mix here in Wisconsin and globally?
Yeah, I guess the two. For sure, solar and, you know, what Sarah just talked about of advanced nuclear, whether that ever becomes economical and reliable, that could change things quite a bit and be part of the mix as well. I think the things that are kind of most dynamic right now, like changing the most and could have a big impact if they go in the right direction. One is batteries and storage. So if we continue to have improvements in batteries that make electric vehicles affordable, that allow you to drive, say, more than 200 miles on a charge, which we already have, and having those be both long range and affordable, that makes a big difference. Can those batteries get designed, and maybe different types of batteries, not the cars kind we put in phones and laptops and cars, but other ones that, where you could have the storage last a long time, like weeks to months. In that case, it would really help if we generate a lot of solar in the summer to fuel our electricity demand later in the fall. So long-term energy storage and the cost of storage, that's one area that makes a huge difference. It enables renewables. It enables electrification of vehicles. And then the other one, it's a little bit more amorphous, but I think it might have a really big impact, is just incorporating more information technology into the energy system. And so that could be so that, you know, operators of the grid understand where power is being made and how consumers can understand where the power is coming from and how much it costs. And that could have big impacts as well.
Greg, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Enjoy the conversation.
Sarah, thank you for being here. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Sarah Johnston, Assistant Professor of Natural Resource Economics at UW-Madison. Greg Nemeth, Professor of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.